It is now my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker with 17 years from Kingsburg, Dave F.
My name's Dave and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 5/29/2001. I remember that date both in infamy and also as the start of my new life. I found out that real early, you know, I think I had probably a month or two in the program, and someone told me, you really only have today. So when I saw all of you coming up with, you know, various amounts of sobriety, today's what counts, and only this 24 hours is what's been given to me. And I've been fortunate enough to run a few of those together. And when I walk in the door here, well, first of all, I should clarify. My sponsor said I should dress like this, okay? Because when you show up, you stand out, and I said, really? And he goes, yeah. He goes, you may not wear it again for a while, but when you're representing, why not? And so, you know, I don't usually wear a tie, but my wife said it looks good on me. So, and I'll do it again. Anytime I have a chance to speak, I'll wear the proper attire to represent not just myself, but my fellowship in Kingsburg, you fellow alcoholics that are recovering. I have to make sure that I keep in mind that each day is precious. And just like I was talking just a minute ago, it's like I'm a blessed man. I'm thankful and I'm grateful. I'm somewhat humble, which is kind of unusual for the way I lived, you know, half my life. But I did find the humility in this program. And it started pretty early for me too. I was exposed to full-blown alcoholism at about 6 or 7 years old. Not that I was drinking, but everyone around me was drinking. My mom and my dad really liked drinking a lot. And they were good at it. They were good at it for a while. And as I got older, their drinking got more intense. And then it became like a contest to see which one might be able to pass away first. And I was the youngest of four kids, so by the time I was 10, 11 years old, they had split up, and my mom and my next oldest brother were living on welfare, and which I didn't know one way or the other, except I just knew that I had to take care of my mom, and she continued down that path of drinking Thunderbird and stuff like that. So I was exposed to some things that I'm sure some of you can attest to or relate to or whatever. But I had my first drink at 13. And living in the projects, I went across the street to the neighbor's house, and I asked the kid, I said, hey, have you ever drank before? And he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, my mom's got a stash of fruit-flavored wines underneath the cupboard in the kitchen. And I said, really? So, now, understand, I'm 13 at the time, and I'm about this tall, so I'm one of the shortest people in my class. And he said, just don't drink too much out of each bottle. Just take a little bit out of each one. And so, you know, I started with the peach and got to the blueberry and I'd taken drinks out of at least six bottles, and the next thing I remember, I was waking up with, I take that back. I got a buzz really quickly. I mean, like rapidly. And then it was gone and I had blacked out. And my mom, of all people, had to come across the street and carry me home. And, I had tossed all over myself and, you know, it wasn't a pretty sight. But, she took care of me and that wasn't a very good experience for my first drinking. So I didn't do it after a while. I mean, I didn't do it through high school. I would drink like socially, but I would never really, you know, get stupid on alcohol. I did try a few other things and, you know, I told myself, whatever I do, I'm not going to be like my parents. Whatever I do, I'm not going to be like them. So I did exactly all the other things that were, you know, cool and hip, through high school. And still lived on the projects, and my mom passed away at I was 17 years old, so she passed away right between me graduating from high school and me going my first year of college. And my dad was nowhere to be found, by the way. He would show up once in a while, and he was just disruptive, so it was totally dysfunctional, and I didn't know any better. I knew that something was wrong, but I hid it really well from my friends, and nobody at school knew that I lived in that kind of a environment. And so when she passed away, she won the contest. So, because he lived on till I was like 30, 31 years old. So anyway, I still wasn't an alcoholic. At least I couldn't. I mean, that's not what I was doing. And so I moved in with my sister. And she lived in a $350,000 house in Selma. And so I went from this, you know, meager means to pretty much everything was given to me, everything. And I didn't have to pay for any of it. And so I proceeded to do some crazy things. I actually got to the point where, you know, I thought, cocaine was the greatest thing on earth, and I'm telling you this because it all led back to alcohol. Everything led back to alcohol. By the time I was 2 years in college, I had been diagnosed bipolar, and because I had pretty much lost it and gone off the deep end, and I'm sure some of you are familiar with that too. Manic depression. I just found myself lost, and so they tried to put me in the system in Fresno County Mental Health, and instead of me taking the medication that they gave me, I was snorting it, and I'm doing all like really crazy stuff, and I was trying to turn it on to my friends, and they're going, "What are you talking about? Man, get away from me," you know. And anyway, I rejected the help. At that point, all the help that was being offered to me. And so I became homeless because my sister didn't want anything to do with me. My brother didn't want anything to do with me. Next thing I know, I was living on the streets in Fresno. And so a guy came up to me one day and he says, "Hey, I got a job for you if you want to go to Texas with me." I go, "What?" He goes, "Yeah, oil fields in East Texas. It's booming right now." He goes, "All you got to do is help me drive there." And so I drove. I drove him all the way to Texas because he was worthless, I found out later. And we ran out of money in San Diego. So, yeah, we had 40 bucks when we left Fresno. And then the next thing I know, he goes, "What are we going to do?" I go, "What do you mean, what are we going to do?" I go, "I'll show you." And so the first stop was a Burger King. And I said, "Pull up to the drive-thru." And we did that, and I told him, I said, "We had a couple of rancid Whoppers for lunch, man. They were terrible. So we want our money back." And the girl on the speaker says, "You'll have to come up and talk to the manager." And got up to the window, and the manager goes, "Do we got a receipt?" And I said, "No, I have no receipt. We were in a rush. We had to get back to work." And He goes, well, how about a couple more Whoppers? That'll work. So from that point on in San Diego, all the way to East Texas, I showed this guy how to hustle. And I didn't even know I had it in me. I didn't know that I had all this, you know, bullshit in me. And so, wait, what about gas, right? We're completely out of gas. And at the time, it was pump now, pay later at 7-Elevens. This will work. So we pulled up there, sure enough, pumped and split. And I'm sure that there had to be a warrant out for us or whatever. There's no doubt. But we did it. We did it all the way to East Texas. And we get to, don't worry. I mean, it took 3 or 4 days to get it all done. We get to his mom's house. He says, hold on, stay in the car. He goes up to his mom on the front porch, and she says, and I go, well, so he walks back over to me and he goes, you got 2 days, you got to. I go, what about the oil fields? What about this big deal? He goes, it fell through. I said, dude, you're about ready to fall through. You know, and I mean it, I was pissed. So I got the local newspaper. Hey, young guys and gals, free to travel? Join our sales group. So I go to the local motel, and get an interview with this pretty young girl, and she says, well, we're selling magazines door to door, state to state. Can you think you can do it? I said, yeah, I think I can do it. So they sent me to San Antonio, and they're from Houston, and then, I mean, they trained me a little bit on how to sell magazines, but it was like living with a bunch of gypsies. You know, I mean, it was really wild. And I have nowhere to go. I have nowhere to look. But here's the kicker. Now I'm 21, 22 years old. And there's nothing for me on the street. So I made enough money to sit in the bar all my time off and drinking kamikazes by the dozen and, you know, doing all kinds of, you know, drinking profusely, you know, and then I knew I might have a problem with alcohol then. And it went on for a year and a half selling magazines. And, there was a time when I realized that I couldn't remember what had happened the day before. And, this girl says, well, let's get a room tonight. I said, well, I'm not allowed to sleep with girls. And she goes, well, tonight I'm a manager. We can do it. And so we got so knockered that the next morning I woke up and the room was thrashed. The room was completely destroyed. And I'm thinking to myself, first thing I thought was, man, she's pretty strong. You know, I was a full blown alcoholic. I was blacking out. I was, one was too many and 1,000 not enough. All that was going on. And so, mind you, I'm bipolar, right? Untreated bipolar. And so that's how I was maintaining. My other disease was with alcohol. I could self-medicate and keep myself from, you know, blowing up and down. So finally I went to the guy in charge and I said, I need to go back to California. And he told me, he said, nah. He goes, you got to stick around and be a manager for me. I go, no, I'm telling you right now, it's time for me to leave. He goes, well, how much money do you owe me? And I go, what do you mean? He goes, well, everybody here owes me money. That's how I keep them around in bondage. You know, they work for less than what they spend. And so that's how I keep them hanging. I go, well, check your books, check your ledger. I said, I'm one of the exceptions to that. And he looked in the book and he goes, oh my gosh, I owe you $583. I go, yeah. Yeah. And I'd like that now. I'd like that right now. And he goes, no, really, I got a great deal for you. You can have your own van. You can have your own crew. you can, you know, and I go, no. I said, it's time for me to leave. And he goes, well, you know what? You've been good to me. He goes, I'll give you a one-way ticket to Fresno right now. It was around Christmas time, too, 1983. And anyway, I left the magazine crew. And I left a bunch of people that were worse off than me, and I was derelict. I was terrible. And yet they were asking me for advice and stuff. You know, it was like, what is really going on here? But I knew that I'd come back to an extent, even though I was a lush bucket, I was still able to think my way through some stuff. And so I get back to Fresno and back to Dinuba, where I actually live to this day. And a friend of a friend, I should tell you this. I had a grandmother, which was my father's mother, she was pure. Grandma Feltsy. She was awesome. I mean, she was the one part of my life that I could consistently count on. And she would always let me in, no matter what a disgusting mess I was. She would let me in and she'd feed me and she'd let me sleep and all that. So she's the one that picked me up in Fresno. On, you know, just December of 83. And so I'm living with her, and a friend of mine from the old days comes back and says, hey, man, I want you to meet this girl. And so through a friend of a friend, his girlfriend and this other girl are best friends, and then I realize I've known her my whole life, basically, this girl that he's trying to introduce me to. And She's my wife of 32 years. You know what I mean? And mind you, she put up with a lot of crap over the years. I mean, she married me, and I often wondered, you know, her judgment on that, you know? And then, you know, we raised two children dysfunctionally. Because I was never there. I was always working, and I'm sure you guys have all... My sponsor told me this the other night, and it makes a lot of sense. He said, yeah, I drank and drank and drank after work, and when my wife called me, I would tell her I was clearing my head, that I was just, you know, stretching my legs and making sure that I, you know, gave myself some time after work, you know, 5 hours later or whatever it is. And I did the same exact thing. I did the exact same thing. So I could really relate to that. And a lot of time went by in an alcoholic family that I carried on another generation because I was a drinking fool. I would come home from work sometimes. And she would try to talk to me, and I would just put my hand up like that, and I'd go to the refrigerator, and I'd get not one, but two Coors Lights, set them on the kitchen counter, and shotgun them one after another, just to make myself right enough to where I could speak to her. And, yeah, I was good at that too. I was really good at that, because it was like, survival. It was like a, you know, with the mentality that I had as an alcoholic, I was just trying to survive this disease that I'm toying with and playing with. So anyway, years go by. My kids are 11 and 13 at the time. And I go to work one day, and mind you, still not doing anything for manic depression. Still full-blown. And I called a couple guys out because they were messing with me, you know. And I said, both of you come out, not just one. Both of you come out, step out in the front. And that didn't go over well. No matter what the situation was, whether they deserved it or not, one of the secretaries came out and broke us up. And the general manager wasn't there that day. So when he got back, he suspended me for 10 days. Now, mind you, this is. This is a week and a half before Memorial Day 2001. And I got home, and my My wife wasn't too happy with me. She was pretty disgusted. Especially when I was telling her my version of the story. She goes, I don't want to hear that crap. You know, I've heard that crap for 20 years. And I go, honey, you don't understand. She goes, oh, yeah, I understand. She goes, it's crap or get off the pot time. She goes, there's a phone number that you can call at my place of business and turn yourself in as an alcoholic and whatever else. And so my brother and my sister showed up. It was a full-blown intervention and in the backyard of my own house. And I dialed the phone number. I called that 800 number, employee assistance program. And the lady comes on and she goes, are you not? She didn't even ask who I was or anything. She goes, are you an alcoholic? I go, yeah, I believe I am. She goes, anything else I need to know? I go, well, I'm bipolar too. And she goes, well, we can help you. We can help you right now. And from that moment that I was just thinking that I was going to get out of getting fired, because once you call those programs, they can't fire you. And I found out, yeah, this is going to work out good. I get my, you know, and my wife's over there going, you know, she was livid. She was fed up with me, man. I hadn't slept for 3 days, you know, that kind of deal. And so, I got a psychiatrist and I got a psychologist. I got a therapist. I got an outpatient program, 8 weeks outpatient program at a place called the 11th Hour in Fresno. And, I started to do the deal. I started to, one step at a time, I started making my appointments. I went to see, I went to a lot of different, institutions, but the one thing that they all told me at the end, I mean, they prescribed me the proper medication for my bipolar and every one of them said to me, what you need to do is you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous for the rest of your life. So we can help you right now for a week or a month, but if you want to stay sober for the rest of your life, you go to AA. You become a member of AA. And I said, yeah, right, blah, blah, blah. And then the people at 11th Hour said, you're going to go to 3 meetings a week, whether you like it or not. And you had a little card to sign, and you know, just like the court cards from the court system. And the reason I smile, because this process saved my life, and it saved the life of some other people around me too. And I'm not saying anything's perfect, but there's a progress involved with this. For this program that you're all involved in too. So, I went to a lot of meetings. I think they said 90 meetings in 90 days is always a suggestion. Well, I might not have made that. I might not have made that exact number, but it was pretty close. Because once I started feeling it, I realized that, the first few weeks that I went to a meeting, it felt like I was apart from the people inside, that I was different, you know, but I was told, keep going back, you know, one day I walked in and I realized that I was just as weird as everybody else in the room. You know what I mean? I was okay. I was okay with, you know, being comfortable in my own skin all of a sudden, to an extent. But I had all this work to do, and I was told to get a sponsor, you know, and I got a sponsor. Don't ask me, his judgment was almost as bad as my wife when she married me. Yeah, so he asked me to, or I asked him to be my sponsor, and he said, well, let's try that out. Let's see how that works. And he's been instrumental to me in my sobriety, because no matter what the instance is or whatever's going on, or, you know, problems or causes and conditions or whatever it is, I could call my sponsor and he'll respond. And it's nice to know that I don't have to do this alone. And none of you have to do it alone either. Not one of you has to do it alone. You choose to be part of, and there's always going to be there someone to carry the torch for you too, you know. And I should talk to you about my higher power, because without him, you know, doing what I can't do for myself, I would be nothing. I would be lost again. And what's nice about this program is that it doesn't have to be the same higher power for everybody. You can have your own higher power. You can choose your higher power like I chose my higher power, so that I don't have to carry the burden anymore. I don't have to be the king. I don't have to be the one in control. I don't have to be any of that anymore. And so this is something that earlier, the minute of silence, that's the first time I've heard of that. I've heard a moment of silence before, but not a minute. And I mean that. No. I mean, that was fabulous, because of the fact that you get a group of alcoholics to shut their mouth for a minute. That's pretty good, man. That's a miracle. But silence is not bad anymore for me. When I was drinking and I was out there, there had to be some sort of commotion going on all the time. And now it doesn't have to be. I can handle a little prayer and meditation once in a while. And that's what saves me. That's what saves me in a, you know, day at a time, sometimes 10 minutes at a time, whatever I have to do to reset. I also found out that acceptance for me is grasping the concept that everything is exactly the way it is supposed to be right now. And that is a beautiful thing, because I, for so long, you know, 41 years, I tried to put the square peg in the round hole and all that stuff. I did all that crazy stuff that was futile, but I was still going to be the one that did it when it happened. And I don't have to do that anymore. So I really appreciate you guys letting me share tonight and speak, because I'm no youngster anymore. I'm not a youngster anymore, and I want to grow old gracefully. And you helped me to do that. You helped me to grow old gracefully, and that's beyond me. I can't do it alone. So I'll continue to keep coming back. Thanks.
Let's give Dave another round of applause.